Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode 26 of the Driving Eureka podcast, and our subject or theme this week is risk. And you're talking here, Doug, basically all three sections with the book segment and Brain Brew Whiskey Academy too, about reducing risk. And it looks like you've got a new way to do that. Tell us about how you're de-risk, if that's a word. It is a word. De-risking your innovation project.
So this has been a lot of thinking. By the Eureka Ranch team. So I'm sharing what they're thinking about. I didn't come up with this. The thinking went along these lines. Okay, so people buy into the idea of innovation, but the idea of doing it is scary. So theoretically, it's a good idea as a way to grow sales and profits. But I'm kind of scared that we might lose, and I don't want to fail. The ranch team thought about this for a bit, and they said, okay, so we approach it as a system of interconnected parts. What if to de-risk projects, we need to have a place to focus our energy? Because the problem with a system of interconnected parts is if you're not careful, you play whack-a-mole. You grab one part, and then another part, another part, another part, and they never come together. And the team came to the conclusion that the project P&L, the profit and loss statement of what's going to be our revenue, what are going to be the expenses, what's the profits, and related to that, what's the return on investment, that is the one document where the entire innovation system comes onto one piece of paper. And they said, huh. And in that document, if we do the math in the way that we teach at the Eureka Ranch with innovation engineering, if we model the variance or risk, okay? So risk is because a number could be high or it could be low. There's variance in that input. So the number of potential customers, the trial rate, awareness, distribution, repeat rates, how much they're going to buy, when they buy, are they going to make a small purchase or a large purchase? All of the different things that go into a forecast of sales. All the things go into cost, raw materials, packaging, overhead, manufacturing cost, energy, et cetera, et cetera. Each one of those numbers has a degree of risk associated with it. Some of them have small risk or small variance. Some of them have high risk, high variance, because we're really not sure what those are. And so by using the Trailblazer software that the team has created, which allows you to do basically a virtual introduction of your innovation, basically a marketplace simulation where you can introduce it some 10,000 times in the marketplace, you know, virtually. It can predict 5 years of trial, repeat, and diffusion of your innovation into the marketplace, and it gives you the uncertainty so that now you can identify which of the three areas, whether it's in revenue or in cost, that could cause the greatest impact, greatest potential for you to not hit your targets, or where's the areas where you could fail. So now you know where to focus some energy. And kind of cool. You don't need to do it, and you do it with existing projects. So you start with a project that already exists. So you've been working on this project for a while. The team can come in and quickly teach you how to do it. The ranch team would do it to begin with. But then in time, what happens is you take it over and your people get trained to be able to do it yourself. And suddenly we're bringing data. We talked a little while ago about the data was a great way to start to confront some of these risk things. We're dealing with this on a very factual type basis.
Is this an addition then to the software that you already had, or is it kind of a culmination of some of the things that were already in Trailblazer and then adding this component to it?
It's really a culmination. It's like we've been working on different parts of this, from Delphi to rapid testing to a whole lot of different components. And they've all now come together into this whole tapestry where you now have the ability to do it. We didn't have this a couple of years ago. You couldn't do this. We didn't have the capability to do it. We couldn't do all the cost modeling. We couldn't do those things. It's only in the last really two and really even last year that we finally got all of the components to make this possible to do it. It's quite a bit of work, but it's easy once you've got it automated with the software.
Okay, so this is going to help people then know, okay, here's kind of the range, I guess, of what your sales forecast is going to be. This is what costs are associated with it, because these are some of the inputs that you're putting into this P&L, Project P&L software. And then it's going to also tell you, based on, and this is the part I'm trying to understand a little bit better, is going to tell me the amount of risk associated with those inputs.
Okay. That's right. And what we're doing is basically looking at the standard deviation of each divided by the mean, in a general sense, to see what's the relative impact that each one of those have. So we're looking at the standard deviation. So we're going to model those. So when we do a consumer test, you do a consumer test and you get a number. Mm-hmm. Well, the truth is that number actually is a number with a plus or minus with it. And sometimes there's wide agreement on your offering, and sometimes there's not. We use that variance in the model. So the crazy thing about this is sometimes the companies already have all this data, but they're not looking at it in this way. Now, there's usually some missing. There's usually a third to half that they don't have in this way, which we have to get them. And we show them how to do that. But they've got a lot of this information to make it smarter, but they've just not been taught. Statistics was not exactly a class that many people took for fun.
So if I have a product out there, and we're working on it, we're doing different things, but we're still not sure what my P&L is going to look like for this particular product. But basically, you're going to come in with the software, say, okay, we're going to need the data for this. Do you have these things? And if they have them, you're going to input it in. And if they don't, you're going to help them find the other things on the checklist.
The things to do the P&L, the assumptions in the P&L. We're gonna help them get it. We're gonna show them some new ways that they've never done before. And oftentimes on critical numbers, what we'll do is we'll measure three times, cut once, to use the thing where we will measure like the persuasion ability of the idea with three different methods, so to increase our confidence in the number that we got.
Okay, so you're going to take their existing numbers, refine those even before it goes in, based on, off of some of the things that you already know by some of the questions that you're going to ask them associated with the numbers that they have, and then help them get the ones that they don't.
Yeah, I mean, we've literally, as a team, we've got the staff that we've got now. We've got a new lady, Vicky, who's with us now. In between her, Greg, me, and the others, I mean, we've literally got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of sales forecasts that we've done. Our team's probably done more sales forecasts than any other innovation firm out there. And so we've got a lot of, not only do we have tools, but we've also got miles underneath us of traveling through these things and then seeing what happened and then, learning from that.
Okay. And with this tool, is there some way, if somebody's interested in it, how is there a place we can send them?
You can call, if you're in the U.S. or Canada, you can call 800-INVENTS, INVENTS, to reach the ranch team, or just visit EurekaRanch.com and connect with the folks there, and they can help you with it.
It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. All right, well, let's go to your book segment and reducing risk by understanding variation. Every time I see something on understanding variation, I get really excited. As a matter of fact, someone posted on LinkedIn last week a media firm, I can't remember which paper it was, actually posted a control chart in an article, and I can't even remember what the subject was. I was so excited to see that somebody had actually used it in a publication, because it's one of the tools that's so needed by every organization, and unfortunately, very few people really understand what variation is about and what it does. So when you're talking about reducing risk by understanding variation, I got excited already. So tell me how you're using an understanding of variation here.
Okay, so people need to understand, and this is a small excerpt from the book, and there's much more than we're going to get through here in a few minutes. But basically, every measurement has, this is basic Deming, has variation to it. There's a plus or minus with it. However, and this can be charted, and systems have a regular variance that has them. You know, there's a certain level of raw material variance that causes variance in your product. I mean, there's certain things that happen. And there's two types of variance. There's common cause and special cause. Common cause are built into the system. So if you have a ruler that only measures to inches, then you're going to have a pretty big variance when you're trying to estimate how many, you know, an eighth or 16th or a 32nd it is. If you have a ruler that goes to 1/32nd, you're going to be much closer. Okay, you're going to have less variance in it. You're still going to have variance because you're going to be looking at it and you're not going to quite see it the same. If three people did it, they might see a little bit different, but it's going to be smaller variance.
You know, Doug, there's just to interject real quick here, Dr. Don Wheeler, he calls that chunky data when you have large measures like that, when you can't go down to, you know, a 16th of an inch or a 32nd of an inch or even more versus, you know, measuring in 1 inch. I just thought I'd interject.
And it depends. And it depends on the system. In some cases, that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's good enough. Yep. On human systems, because the variance is so high, that may be enough. But so that's built into the system, and only we have to change the system to change that. The worker can't do anything about that. And then we have special cause, which is an error by the employee. They didn't follow the procedures. They fell asleep. You know, they just made a mistake. They made a mistake. And we need to first separate common cause from special cause. Because special cause, you retrain the employee, you do this, and they either learned how to do it, or you have to fire them because they're disobeying and they're not following the process, whatever it is. But usually you educate them and they're fine. The common cause is where we need to reduce the variance. And when it comes to the risk associated with innovations, what we find is when we go back to the project P&L and we're looking at that stuff, is there will be variance in it. And so, for example, we'll find variance when we do modeling of how much, what percentage of stores are going to take the offering? What percentage of consumers will be aware of you that you're doing it? What amount of repeat purchase are you going to get? We'll find these numbers sometimes have huge variance associated with them because they're built into the systems that we do it. And so you have to then start to break this down and break this down to reduce this variance in it by running experiments and by changing your offering so to reduce the variance in it. But understanding it, the whole process starts with understanding there is variance in systems and that the system can reduce the variance. And for those of you who say, well, you can't do this with innovation, you're no different than the guy in Mehoopany, Pennsylvania, who told me a paper machine can't be done. They were wrong then and you're wrong now. I mean, it's just reality, okay? And so we've got to reduce the variance in the process in order to do it. But we've got to make sure that we're dealing with common cause, not special cause. Because if you take a special cause and you put in rules to prevent it, you create a hopeless bureaucracy.
Before I met you, I mean, I struggled with trying to understand how, from an innovation standpoint, I would be like everybody else, I think. And I think it's probably something we could spend a couple minutes talking about, is that it is mystifying when you're talking about innovation, because it just seems like there's so many unknowns when you're working on something that's innovation. And it was the first time, you know, when I attended your classes that I started to understand how to go about it. Everything from measuring whether a product is meaningfully unique, which we've talked about in previous episodes, to generating the forecast, to some of the forecasting methodologies, those types of things. You take a couple minutes and just talk about those things.
Well, so we take the variance that we're dealing with, and rather than ignore it, we model it. And in fact, I went at the National Institute of Standards and Technology with the Department of Commerce. I went through a big review with a guy named Jim Philbin on forecasting, and they had never really approved a forecasting system before for innovations. And he sat down and he said, Doug, so they tell me you can tell me how much I'm going to sell. I said, oh, that's ridiculous. Of course I can't do that. He said, what do you mean? I said, because there's variance in the inputs. And if there's variance in the inputs, there has to be variance in the output. He said, so what you're saying is that variance is the fundamental key to being able to model it. I go, yes. He looked at me, he says, you're the first person who's ever understood that. Tell me more. And long story short, after 6 months, he ended up doing a 2-hour presentation on what we were doing because we were modeling that uncertainty as opposed to ignoring the uncertainty. And so all of our test systems, our sales forecasting systems, all of our methodologies take that information that is in that variance and use them to make the forecasts by running Monte Carlo simulations with it. So you start to see the dynamic range, and this is truth. This is true. That variance is true. You know, when we've got this, and sometimes people get mad, they say, Doug, but you're saying we could have results all over the place. And I go, and that's the truth. They go, well, I don't like that. I said, then we have to reduce the variation. It's the same as manufacturing. It's no different. This is no different than reducing the variance of raw materials to make a factory run better and reducing the variance to make sure our innovations hit their numbers. It's the same thing, folks. It's not any different. It's exactly the same. You just didn't have the tools and techniques. And frankly, in Deming's time, you couldn't do them. I mean, because you couldn't do the modeling. Today, with the computers, we can do 10,000 simulations in a microsecond. And we can run permutations and we can run simulations that literally 5 years ago, you couldn't do. I mean, what we were doing 5 years ago was horrifically compared to what we can do now. There are new tools that you're just not even aware of.
You know, it's interesting. When I was taking your class, I was also reading a book that a friend had given me, and it called The Signal and the Noise. It's a book by Nate Silver, who's the statistician that does 538. And
sure, he works sure, for, I know. For,
yep. Yeah. So he had when I was reading that, I was also reading the chapter about how they forecast weather. And I made so many comparisons associated with some of the things that you were talking about that, hey, this, you know, even in weather, let's take the weather first. This one input, if it changes just a little bit, it could change a lot of things. But knowing that is part of the knowledge that you guys bring to the table. From my standpoint, is you know which ones are kind of, okay, we got to watch this one, or we need to dig in deeper to this one because we know that it's really going to affect that particular project or product that someone's working on. And I thought, you know, sometimes you're set up with things that are very similar, but I was fascinating to me how you guys had gone about it and how really it followed that.
Yeah. And when we sit with finance department folks who generally get this pretty quickly, one of the things becomes, do you want to err on the side of false positives or false negatives? And so it becomes more sophisticated. So let's take the weather example. Mm-hmm. You know, when the weatherman says 70% chance of rain, people read that and go, it's going to rain. Mm-hmm. Okay. The fact of the matter is 3 out of 10 times it shouldn't rain for the forecast to be right. That's just the way it works. Mm-hmm. Now, as it turns out, the weather stations, the TV stations have learned this and the newscasts. And so what they do is they increase the odds. So if you look at the government forecast, which you can get a stream for and there's apps for it, it will tell you the true odds. Mm. But what the weather people do for snow and for rain and storms is they increase the odds of bad things happening.
Really?
Because when it doesn't happen, you feel good. So if you're a weatherman, just take the odds and add 10 points and you've got a better chance of people liking your forecasts because their memory, they will remember when you said it wouldn't rain and it did, they get mad. But when it's the other way around, they're happy. So there is a bias. If you read about it, it's hilarious. There is a bias in the weather forecast you're given, and you can look it up yourself. And it's pretty funny.
I gotta tell the story, Doug. I can't remember. It's probably been over 10 years ago, but you know, big event here in Indianapolis is obviously the Indianapolis 500, which happens in the end of May every year. And, one year there was a weather person that was on there and saying, it's going to rain 100%. You know, it's definitely going to rain tomorrow. You know, just be prepared. You know, I wouldn't even go out there. It didn't rain at all that day. I never saw that weathercaster again. I haven't seen that person on that channel. I haven't seen it on that person on any other channel. But it was so funny that this person was so, and it looked bleak. I mean, it had been raining and everything, but the next day came out. It was a little cloudy in the morning, then the sun came out, and everything went on time and everything. Never saw that person again.
I'll tell you that this idea of variance is part of what makes life exciting, is this inherent uncertainty. The inherent uncertainty of these things. And when you become comfortable with uncertainty and you understand that there's variance in things and you learn how to confront this, manage it, reduce it, then it suddenly becomes a lot easier to do things because you don't get as frustrated. And I mean, I don't know. It's just so much better to know this, and because otherwise you're like, I can't believe this happened. How could this have happened? Well, of course it could have happened. You know, I have never found a team when an innovation has failed and they have me do a forensic. So we do these forensics, which I'm beginning to hate doing them because, you know, where they say, well, this has failed. It should have succeeded. I don't know what happened. Something's wrong. And so you start to go in to look at it, and then it's like a search for the guilty, and it just becomes these nasty things. But every time you do it, every single time, and I've been doing these for over 30 years, every time I do one of these, we find that there are some fundamental systemic flaws in the company's systems that are the root cause of it and has nothing to do with this project. This project just happened to hit at the low end of the control chart on two or three variables this time, versus if they did it again, it might hit on the higher end of the control chart. That there's just so much variance in the system. I did it once for a guy. I took the same product. It had been introduced in like 12 different countries, and we did the forecast for them, and we modeled the variance. And the senior executive in charge, the president, he looked at the results, and he says, so what you're telling me is when they come in and tell me a number, I'd be just as good just throwing a dart as the number they're giving me. I said, sir, yes, you're absolutely right. I said, your system is so far out of control. It is a random walk each time. The idea is not what matters here. It's the different elements of the system. When they kick in, the sales and distribution system, you've got huge variance in that.
Very good. Well, it's a lot of fun unless you're a weathercaster. That may not be so much fun. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Okay, well, let's move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Doug, you went to Orlando. You went to Disney World, my favorite place in the world. I did, when I read this section, have a little bit of trouble understanding how the scalability of things relates to risk, or maybe it doesn't, and you just like talking about scalability.
Well, so the issue was, is I was at the Wine and Spirits Wholesaler Association conference, and they had a brand battle. Seven entrepreneurs came up to pitch their product, and when I went through my notes from the event, I was surprised that every single person was asked a variation of, do you have capacity? Can you scale? And interestingly, it's been the same question I've gotten with Brain Brew as I've met with potential customers is, can you scale? Do you have volume? And this constraint on capacity is one of the greatest barriers to craft spirit success. And if we're not careful, what happens is this. We spend so much time getting started, we don't take the time to put in place systems to reduce variation in our process. And so as a result, when we start to scale, the system quality just becomes a disaster. I mean, it's typical if you're doing hundreds of cases and then thousands of cases and then tens of thousands of cases with every step change. What happens is that, you know, when you're small, you can do workarounds. Oh, that's a little off here. I'll adjust it here. This is a little off. I'll adjust it here. But as you get bigger and bigger, you can't do that. I mean, the system is just cranking and running. And so as we're getting more scale to the thing. And so in order for you to get scalability, you've got to reduce variance. And all of that variance is the risk that you're not going to be able to scale. I mean, it's just all connected. And so those small variances that don't matter when you're small matter a lot when you're big. And so it's easier to build this discipline in when you're small than when you're large. I mean, we went 2018, 10 times what we were supposed to do. 2019 is 10 times what we were originally supposed to do. That's right. We're 1,000 times greater today than we were thought to be in 2019. Thankfully, we worked on variance early on. We didn't have to bring it in today. And so we've been able to scale, still having to deal with challenges, but we've been able to scale because we've reduced that variance. We're much tighter on our wood. We're tighter on our spirit. Our equipment runs at, 10th of a PSI. I mean, very tight tolerances on everything that we're doing so that we can scale.
You know, this is true for almost every industry I can think of. There's stress tests in software where you've tested the software working fine, and then all of a sudden, instead of, 200 claims are coming through the system, let's say in a healthcare environment, now you've got a million claims coming through in a day, and it just breaks the code, basically.
That's right.
And the same thing with equipment. I've seen it in contact centers where they have equipment set up and they've tested it, and then all of a sudden the real call and real volume starts to come in and just explodes. So you have the same issues then in a distillery in that you have these, in essence, bottlenecks that have to be cleared out as you go. And I guess your point here, Doug, is that you need to do them as you're moving forward. Is that kind of your message here?
That's right. You got to get the mindset in at the start. You got, because it's very hard when people have been winging it. It's very hard to suddenly turn around and say, okay, now we need to put some discipline into the decisions that we're making. Mm-hmm. And we need to reduce the variance as we're going along. It's very hard to add that later. And so you need to get that in at the start. You need to get that in at the start, because otherwise you're just going to be frustrated. You're going to be frustrated with it.
So why do you, just out of curiosity, when you read these, why were they asking? They were asking about capacity at this conference and scale, because it's such a big problem in the industry then.
It's a total disaster.
Okay.
It's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster everywhere. In that people can't, you can't scale. You can't get larger. And so it just causes a massive problems. And when they do scale, the quality goes all over the place. Or they just literally don't have capacity. They just don't have the capacity to do it.
This also brings up, and I know we talked about this before, but every time I see Joe Gergesh's name, I think of it, which is you try these different woods that you're putting in. And it always kind of blows my mind from a standpoint of wood and variation being so great and how you guys are able to control that.
I mean, that is our focus. I mean, that is literally our focus, is to reduce that variation in that, because the wood is where all the magic happens.
And that's
where all the magic happens.
Is that where you get most of your variation from then?
Well, it actually happens all the way through the process.
Okay.
But the one that we sweat more than anything else is, I mean, that's where the biggest value add happens, is in the wood.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go to your craft cocktail recipe, the strawberry mint julep. You're kind of on a julep roll. This is our third julep recipe that we've had in Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. We had the jalapeno, and then we had your basic in-your-face mint julep that you talked about last week. So what's the strawberry mint julep? Is this something you made up?
Yeah, just, okay. It's just a little bit of fun. Okay. So a basic julep, you know, 5 leaves of mint, a teaspoon of simple syrup, 3 sliced strawberries, muddle it really firmly, add some ice, crushed if you got it, 2 ounces of noble oak, stir and enjoy, maybe with a strawberry as a garnish. And it's kind of a fun way to open it up. Tones down the mint a little bit. Strawberry and mint play well together, very well together. And so it's just a perfect summer, kind of spring, summer refresher. Add a little bit of champagne, sparkling wine to it, and it becomes even more magnificent.
Okay. So are you doing something with the sliced strawberries, or are you just adding them into the
I'm drink? Muddling them.
You are muddling them. Okay. Yep. I wasn't sure because I knew you didn't have to muddle simple syrup. But so when I saw that on there, I wanted to make sure that was being muddled also. Sounds like another interesting drink to try. And you've got your noble oak bourbon in there again. All right. Yeah. Very good. Any final comments for our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy?
No, it's just folks, when you get into this kind of stuff, you've got to look at the variation. Look at the variation associated with things. I mean, that's the whole key to this whole process. And the more you get to understand that variation and make it your friend instead of your enemy, instead of being a victim to it, the more successful and the more fun you're going to have.
Well, that concludes this week's Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.DougHall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.